Hi, and welcome back to A Twist of Fate. In this week's episode, we are talking about Dennis Nilsen. Dennis Nilsen was born on November 23, 1945, in Fraserburgh, Aberdeenshire. He was the middle child of Elizabeth White and Olaf Moksheim, who was the one to adopt the last name Nilsen. Moksheim had been a Norwegian soldier who had gone to Scotland in 1940 with the Free Norwegian Forces when Germany had occupied Norway. He and Elizabeth had gotten married after a short time dating, and the couple had gotten married in May of 1942 and moved into Elizabeth's parents' house. The Nilsen marriage was rocky. Olaf didn't really take his marriage all that seriously. He spent most of his time with his fellow soldiers and didn't try very hard to fit his new wife into his life. After she had given birth to their last child, Elizabeth couldn't help but think that she had rushed into her marriage, and they divorced in 1948. Elizabeth's parents, Andrew and Lily, never liked Olaf, so they supported her decision to divorce him. Dennis Nilsen was definitely considered a quiet kid, however, he did like to explore. His earliest memories as a child were having family picnics in the Scottish countryside and going on long walks with his grandfather and sometimes his other siblings. Even though he was only 5 years old, his grandfather would take him on long walks across the beach and through sand dunes. Nilsen described this part of his childhood as content. He later described his grandfather as being his great hero and protector, before he added that whenever his grandfather would go to sea, Andrew was a fisherman, life would be empty until he returned. However, by 1951, Nilsen's grandfather's health started to decline. Despite this, he continued to work. 62-year-old Andrew White died on Halloween in 1951. He had suffered from a heart attack while he had been fishing on the North Sea. At his funeral, Elizabeth had asked Dennis if he wanted to see his grandfather's body. When he said yes, she showed him and explained to him that he was sleeping and that he had gone to a better place. After his grandfather died, Nilsen became more withdrawn and liked to spend his time alone at the harbor watching the herring boats. He rarely interacted with family, and he hardly ever participated in family activities. Once he started noticing the amount of attention his siblings were getting compared to him, he started to resent his family, and he hated how popular his brother Olaf Jr. was. Despite feeling out of place, Nilsen still felt close to Sylvia, his little sister. Once he had started going through puberty, he had discovered that he was gay, which confused him and made him ashamed of himself, which ended with him deciding to keep it a secret. At some point, Nilsen had found himself attracted to boys that have similar features to his little sister. At least one occasion, he had sexually groped Sylvia. He believed that his attraction to men was just a sign for how much he cared for his sister. He had also done the same thing to his older brother, which ended with Olaf Jr. suspecting his brother was gay and mocking him for it. As Dennis got older, he really started to realize that the small-town lifestyle wasn't for him, after he had seen how little opportunities there were. He started to see that his parents weren't doing anything to help themselves or the family and had enough. After really seeing that he no longer wanted to live that life, he joined the Army Cadet Force to train as a chef, seeing the British Army as a potential way out. Nilsen had passed his entrance exams and had received his official letter stating that he would be enlisted for 9 years. He would be doing his training with the Army Catering Corps at St. Omer Barracks in Aldershot, Hampshire. Within a few weeks of being there, Nilsen started to soar in his duties. He later described these weeks as the happiest of his life. When Nilsen passed his initial catering exam, he was officially assigned to the 1st Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers in Osnabrück, West Germany, where he would be serving as a private. During this deployment, Nilsen and his buddies had started drinking a lot. Some of his colleagues had said that Nilsen would overdrink to ease his social anxiety and shyness. One night, he had gotten drunk with a German teen and woke up on the teen's apartment floor. Even though nothing sexual happened, it still fueled his imagination. He started to fantasize about his sexual partners being young, thin, and completely passive. Those fantasies then upgraded to him wanting his partners to be unconscious or even dead. Nilsen had made it a habit to try and get his fellow soldiers to feel him up whenever he was drunk. He would pretend that he was absolutely wasted, hoping that his buddies would try to take advantage of him while he was passed out drunk. After serving 2 years in West Germany, Nilsson went back to Aldershot, where he took his official catering exam and passed before he had been sent to Norway to serve as a cook for the British Army. He was then deployed to the state of Aden and had served as a cook at Al-Mansura prison. This deployment had been the worst for him. He had lost several men, most of the time in ambushes. One time, Nilsson had even been kidnapped by a taxi driver, who had beaten him till he was unconscious before putting him in the trunk of his taxi. However, once they had stopped and Nilsson was let out, he had been ready with a jack handle and knocked the driver unconscious before putting his body in the trunk. When his deployment ended, Nilsson went back to the United Kingdom and had then been assigned to serve at the Seaton Barracks with the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders in Plymouth, Devon. Here he was required to cook for 30 soldiers and 2 officers every day. He stayed here until 1969 when him and the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders were moved to Cyprus. Only months later, they were stationed in West Berlin. While stationed here, Nilsson had his first sexual experience with a woman. He had solicited a sex worker before going and bragging about it to his colleagues. Later on, he claimed that he found sex with women overrated and depressing. After a brief time deployed in Inverness, Nilsson had been selected to cook for the Queen's Royal Guard before being reassigned in January of 1971 to the Shetland Islands. The corporal ended his 11-year military career here in October the next year. Between the time he ended his career in October until December, Nilsson had stayed with family, trying to figure out what his next steps in life were. In the 3 months that he lived with his parents, his mother had stated several times how she wished he would find a girl and start a family. One time, Nilsson had joined his older brother, his wife, and another couple in watching a documentary on gay men. When Dennis had started sticking out for gay rights, Olaf Jr. decided to go and tell their mom that Nilsson was gay. After this, he never talked to Olaf Jr. again, and he kept in very little contact with his mother and younger siblings by sending them letters. In December, he finally had enough and moved to London, where he joined the Metropolitan Police and started his training. Nilsson completed his training in April of 1973 and was then sent to Willesden Green. He enjoyed working there. However, he missed the bond him and his army buddies had shared, so he had started drinking alone when he would get off of work. In the summer and fall time, he had started going to gay bars and having casual sex with men. He didn't like these mindless hookups and described them as soul-destroying, and he said that he had only been doing it in a vain search for inner peace, because he really only wanted a long-lasting relationship. In August, after getting out of a relationship, Nilsson decided that his lifestyle didn't fit with his job. That same month, his dad had died and left all of his kids £1,000. Nilsson finally decided to resign from the force in December. He then found a job working as a security guard. When he found the work to be intermittent, he decided to find a more stable job. In May of 1974, he found himself working as a civil servant. He worked at a job center in Denmark Street, helping people with less experience find jobs. Here he was considered a sheepish and hardworking employee. Nilsson's attendance record was average, however, he would volunteer when any overtime opportunities would come up. He was officially promoted in 1979 to executive officer with few additional supervisor responsibilities. In November of 1975, Nilsson met 20-year-old David Gallican while he was being threatened by 2 men outside of a bar. After he helped David out, the two of them went back to Nilsson's room where they spent the night just talking and drinking. That night, he learned that David was gay, didn't have a job, and had been staying in a hostel. The next morning, the two men agreed to live together in a bigger place, which was bought by using the inheritance Nilsson had gotten from his father. They had checked out and moved into a bottom-floor apartment at 195 Melrose Avenue. Before moving in, Nilsson had negotiated with their new landlord that the couple have exclusive use of the garden at the back of the building. Nilsson learned quickly how little David wanted to work and started viewing himself as the breadwinner of the household. He later had said that even though he was sexually attracted to the man, they never had sex. Their bliss only lasted a year before they fell apart. The couple had started sleeping in separate beds and would even bring casual partners back to the house for the night. David later insisted that Nelson was never physically violent towards him, only verbally, which had increased in the early months of 1976. After a pretty heated fight, Nelson had kicked David out, and that's when David decided to end the relationship. After they had split, Nelson did go and try to be in other relationships. However, none lasted more than a few weeks, and none of the men he saw were interested in living with him permanently. By the end of 1978, he was living a solitary life, only putting effort into his work. Dennis Nelson killed his first victim on December 30th, 1978. The victim happened to be 14-year-old Stephen Holmes. He had met the young teen in Cricklewood Arms Pub when the 14-year-old failed his attempt at buying alcohol. Thinking this kid was 17, Nelson invited him back to his place where they drank so much they had passed out. The next morning, after spending some time just laying with the teenager, he decided that this kid was going to stay with him whether he wanted to or not. In the next few moments, Nelson had used one of his neckties to strangle the 14-year-old until he was unconscious before killing him by drowning him in a bucket of water. He then washed the body, then masturbated over it twice before letting rigor mortis set in so he could place the body under the floorboards. Stephen's body stayed under those floorboards until Nelson burned his body on August 11, 1979. Exactly 2 months later, on October 11th, he tried to murder Andrew Ho, a foreign exchange student from Hong Kong. He met Andrew at St. Martin's Lane Pub and had gotten him back to the house under the ruse of them hooking up. Back at Nelson's place, Andrew had managed to get away from the man and escape before going to the police. However, he didn't press charges. On December 3rd, 1979, while drinking in a pub in the West End, Nelson met 23-year-old Kenneth Okendale. He had been visiting his British family from Canada. After finding out that he was just visiting, Dennis decided to offer to show him around the sights. On the way back to his place, they had stopped to get more alcohol. Nelson had been adamant that he couldn't remember when exactly he had killed Kenneth. He did, however, remember strangling him while the man had been using Nelson's headphones to listen to music. Nelson then poured himself a glass of rum while listening to music with the headphones the young man he just killed had been wearing. The next day, he went and bought a Polaroid camera and took pictures of Kenneth's dead body in numerous sexual positions before putting his body under the floorboards just like he had Stephen Holmes. Nelson had taken the body out at least 4 times, just sitting the body next to him on the couch while he drank and watched TV. His next victim, 16-year-old Martin Duffy, had been killed on May 17, 1980. The 16-year-old had been hitchhiking on May 13th without his parents knowing, after he had been questioned by police for trying to evade paying the train fare. Nelson had met the teen while coming back from a union meeting in Southport. Duffy had been extremely tired and starving. He happily accepted Nelson's offer to go back to his place for a meal and an actual bed. While Martin was sleeping, Nelson sat on his chest and strangled him until he was unconscious before dragging him to the kitchen and drowning him in the sink. After he bathed the body, he first sat him down on a chair in the kitchen before moving him to the bed. Martin's body was kept in a cupboard for 2 days before he started to notice the signs the body was starting to bloat, and Nelson then moved him to under the floorboards. Before the end of 1980, Nelson had killed 5 more people. The only thing Nelson actually claimed to remember was how graphic each killing had been and how long he had waited before dismembering and dissecting his victims. Eventually, the bodies hidden underneath Nelson's floorboards attracted insects and started to smell. He attempted to aid the situation by putting deodorants in the floorboards and spraying insecticide twice every day. However, nothing could help his situation at this point. In late 1980, Nelson decided to burn all of his victims' bodies in a communal bonfire that he had built behind his apartment. Needing to hide the smell of burning bodies, he had also burned an old car tire along with them. He waited for the fire to die down before using a rake to pick through the ashes for any bones that could be intact. He did find one skull that was left intact, which he then crushed with his rake. Nelson's final victim at this apartment was Malcolm Barlow. He had met the 23-year-old slumped against his wall outside of his house. When he had gotten Barlow to open up, he explained that his epilepsy medication had a side effect that made his legs feel weak. After suggesting he go to a hospital, Nelson got Barlow inside and called for an ambulance. When he was released the next day, he had gone back to Nelson's house to thank him. Nelson invited Malcolm in and made him a meal before the young man fell asleep on the couch. He then strangled the man and then hid his body under the kitchen sink the next morning. In mid-1981, Nilsson's landlord decided to do some renovations to his place and had asked Nilsson to leave the property. However, he only left after accepting the offer of £1,000 from his landlord to leave. On October 5th, he moved into 23D Cranley Gardens, which was located in the Muswell Hill district in North London. Before he left his apartment, however, he needed to get rid of the bodies in the house. That day, Nilsson burned the last five of his victims, again disguising the smell by burning an old car tire along with them. While living here, he didn't have access to a garden, and because he had an attic apartment, he obviously couldn't hide any bodies under the floorboards. So for almost 2 months, he had refrained from killing. However, on November 23rd, he met 19-year-old Paul Nobbs, and he did try to strangle him, but decided not to. In March of 1982, Nilsson met 23-year-old John Hallett in a pub. He lured the young man back to his house by promising they would continue drinking and could watch a movie. They had watched a movie before John made his way into Nilsson's room and fell asleep in his bed. He sat there at the end of his bed for an hour, just watching his new acquaintance sleep, deciding whether or not to kill him. After eventually deciding to kill the man, Nilsson did try to strangle John. However, the man fought back and tried to kill Nilsson instead. Once he was able to get the upper hand, Hallett was strangled with a strap. It took him three different tries to kill him since the man refused to die. Nilsson had killed John Hallett by drowning him in his bathtub. Hallett's handprint remained around Nilsson's neck for the next week. In May later that year, he met 21-year-old Carl Stotter in the Black Cat pub in Camden. Nilsson had invited him back to his place after learning that he was depressed after a failed relationship. When the young man had fell asleep in a sleeping bag, he woke up to being strangled and Nilsson whispering, "Stay still." At Nilsson's trial, Carl stated that he thought he had been trying to get him unstuck from the zipper of the sleeping bag before he fell asleep again. He heard the sound of running water before he could realize that what was happening, Nilsson had already been attempting to drown him. After believing that he had killed the 21-year-old, he sat him in a chair. However, he noticed his dog licking the young man's face and realized there was still a tiny bit of life left in there. Thinking quickly, he covered him in blankets before telling him the story that he had gotten caught on the zipper of the sleeping bag after having a nightmare and that he had brought him back to life. Nilsson then led the young man to a train station where he told Hallett that he hopes they had meet again before saying goodbye. Nilsson killed his final victim on January 26, 1983. This victim had been 20-year-old Stephen Sinclair. The young man had last been seen by some of his acquaintances walking with Nilsson in the direction of the train. Sinclair had fell asleep back at Nilsson's place before Nilsson found himself once again strangling the young man with a ligature he made from a necktie and rope. His body had then been dismembered, with some parts being put into plastic bags and kept in a wardrobe, a chest, or sometimes a drawer that was under the bathtub. Nilsson tried to get rid of any stray pieces by flushing them down the toilet, which he had done at his previous house. He then boiled Sinclair's head, feet, and hands to get the flesh off those pieces. Michael Catran, a Dino Rod employee, was the one who responded to the complaints at Nilsson's complex on February 8, 1983, and found the evidence to Nilsson's crimes. He had found flesh and small bones after opening up a drain cover at the side of the house. He immediately called his supervisor and told him the situation, and the two had decided to wait until the next morning because Katrin hadn't gotten to the building until dark. The two returned to the building at 7:30 the next morning. However, they found that the drain had already been mysteriously unclogged. Katrin found some of the scraps of flesh and a few bones in a pipe that led from the drain of the apartment at the very top of the house. When the men started to realize that what they were looking at kind of looked like a human hand, they immediately called the police. When investigators got to the building, they couldn't tell if the bones belonged to a small animal or a human, so they had taken them to a pathologist, David Bowen, and he did confirm that they were human remains. When they had found out that the top floor apartment belonged to Nilsson, Detective Chief Inspector Peter Jay and two of his colleagues decided to wait outside of the building until Nilsson came home. When he finally got home, Jay introduced himself and the two men he was with and explained that they had some questions about the blockages in the pipes to his apartment and asked to come in. Immediately, when the three investigators had entered Nilsson's home, the smell of rotting flesh hit them. After a few questions, Jay finally told Nilsson that the block had been caused by someone flushing human flesh and bones down the drain, to which the man expressed an obviously fake shock expression. In response, Jay stated, "Don't mess about, where's the rest of the body?" That's all it took for Nilsson to calmly tell them that they could find the parts in his wardrobe in two plastic bags. They didn't immediately open it, and instead asked if there were any other places he has body parts hidden. Nilsson only replied, "It's a long story. It goes back a long time. I'll tell you everything. I want to get it off my chest, not here at the police station." He was immediately arrested and taken to the Hornsey police station. On the way, police asked if the remains in his home were those of one or two people, to which Nilsson replied, 15 or 16 since 1978. That night, Detective Superintendent Chambers, DCIJ, and Bowen all went to Nilsson's home, found the remains, and took them to Hornsey Mortuary. One bag had two dismembered torsos, and a shopping bag had been found that contained a variety of internal organs. Another bag had been found that had a human skull, a severed head, and a torso with the arms still attached. However, the hands had been removed. Nilsson's trial started on October 24, 1983. He had been charged with 6 counts of murder and 2 counts of attempted murder. He was tried before Mr. Justice Croom Johnson at the Old Bailey, and he had pleaded not guilty to all charges. The main argument wasn't whether or not Nilsson had killed these men, however, it was about his mental state at the time of each killing. The defense was arguing that Nilsson had suffered from diminished responsibility that had rendered him completely incapable of even forming the thought to commit murder and should only be convicted of manslaughter. The prosecution explained everything that had happened in February of that year that led to the human remains being identified in Nilsson's arrest. The finding of 3 dismembered bodies at his house, Nilsson's detailed written confession, him physically leading the investigators to charred bones of the 12 victims he had killed while living at Melrose Avenue, and how far Nilsson went to hide these killings. Prosecutor Alan Green, QC, ended his opening statements by quoting an answer Nilsson had given them when they had asked if he needed to kill. Nilsson had said, "At the precise moment of the act, I believe I am right in doing the act." Green then added, "The Crown says that even if there was a mental abnormality, that was not sufficient to diminish substantially his responsibility for these killings." During witness testimonies, DCIJ told the court how calm and collected Nilsson had been while giving his confession, before he read several of Nilsson's statements before he had been arrested. One of these had been Nilsson saying, "I have no tears for my victims, I have no tears for myself, nor those bereaved by my actions." The investigator admitted that it was a little shocking for someone who committed crimes of this level to be so open with the details. After his testimony, D.S. Chambers stated Nilsson's formal confession to the court, including the graphic details of the both ritualistic and sexual acts that Nilsson would perform with the bodies, the methods used to store the bodies and body parts, and so much more. Multiple members of the jury had gotten visibly upset throughout the testimony, and others were watching suspiciously as Nilsson listened and remained calm and straight-faced. On October 31st, Paul Bowden had been called to testify as a rebuttal to the psychiatrist that testified for the defense. Before the trial, Bowden had interviewed Nilsson 16 separate times. These interviews totaled over 14 hours. Bowden testified for 2 days that even though he did find that Nilsson was abnormal in a colloquial sense, he concluded that he was a manipulative person and who was capable of forming relationships, however, forced himself to objectify people. Bowden then further testified that he couldn't find evidence of maladaptive behavior and that Nilsson didn't suffer from any mental illness. The jury was then dismissed on November 3rd to talk through their verdict. The next day, the jury returned, finding Nilsson guilty of 6 counts of murder and 1 count of attempted murder. Nelson was sentenced to life in prison with the recommendation that he serve a minimum of 25 years. After being convicted, he was transferred to HMP Wormwood Scrubs. In December, Nelson had been attacked by Albert Moffitt, another inmate. He had been slashed on his face and chest with a razor blade, which resulted in him getting 89 stitches. After this incident, he was transferred to HMP Wakefield before he was transferred again in 1991 to the Vulnerable Prisoner Unit at HMP Full Sutton until he was transferred again in 1993 to HMP Whitmore as a Category A prisoner. However, he would be transferred back to HMP Full Sutton in 2003 as a Category A prisoner and remained there until he died. Nelson was taken to York Hospital on May 10, 2018 after he had been complaining about having severe stomach pain. It was discovered that he had a ruptured abdominal aortic aneurysm. The aneurysm had been fixed, however, because of the complication from surgery. Nelson suffered from a blood clot and died on May 12th. After a post-mortem examination, Dennis Nelson's cause of death was said to be caused by a pulmonary embolism and retroperitoneal hemorrhage. This has been A Twist of Fate. Thank you so much for listening, and as always, if you have any questions or requests, feel free to message me. Have a great day.